The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And opponents would point out this is a heavy lift for the United States Supreme Court to step in and tell state courts they're doing state law wrong. So it's trying to figure out if the Supreme Court is going to step in with a weaker version of the theory that you've just gone too far, or a stronger version of the theory to suggest that the state constitutions can never substantively constrain the decision making of legislatures. It's going to be a question of where they're choosing to draw those lines and essentially second guess what's happening in the states.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for July 26, 2022. At the end of this past term, the Supreme Court took up the case of Moore v. Harper, a challenge to North Carolina state Supreme Court rulings on elections that promises to confront the controversial independent state legislature doctrine, which argues that the Constitution empowers state legislatures over other state institutions when it comes to deciding certain election matters. Court watchers have posited that the decision could be a major one, as upholding the independent state legislature doctrine could not only hinder the state judicial enforcement of various election-related rights, but potentially strengthen arguments that state legislatures can decide how to allocate their state's electors in presidential elections, a contention that played a central role in some of the legal machinations that former President Donald Trump supporters attempted to pursue following the 2020 election in order to turn the results in his favor. To better understand what exactly is at stake in Moore v. Harper, I spoke to Derek Mueller, a professor at the University of Iowa College of Law and a leading election law expert. We discussed what the independent state legislature doctrine may look like in practice, how it intersects with congressional and presidential elections, and what Moore v. Harper does and doesn't mean for the security of U.S. elections moving forward. It's the Lawfare Podcast for July 26th. Derek Mueller on Moore v. Harper and independent state legislature doctrine. So, Derek, we have seen a lot of fire and heat surrounding a decision the Supreme Court made towards the end of its term, actually around a lot of the decisions the Supreme Court made, but one smaller one in particular relating to next term, which is the taking up of a case called Moore v. Harper and its relation to something that we have been discussing for a number of years now, but that is called independent state legislature doctrine that has many people concerned about implications for future elections and people tied to concerns over what almost happened with the 2020 election. Tell us a little bit about the case Moore v. Harper, the facts that led here, and the kind of question that's being presented to the court by it.
Sure. So in Moore, it's specifically dealing with North Carolina's congressional redistricting maps. So all the states were redistricting after the 2020 census, and North Carolina did so. It has a Republican-controlled legislature. Its redistricting maps are some of the few in the country that are not subject to a gubernatorial veto, and the governor's a Democrat. So he probably would have vetoed some of these maps, but instead, the legislature enacted what are described as partisan gerrymanders that opponents say unfairly entrenches Republicans at the expense of Democrats. And in a state that's relatively closely divided on a statewide basis on partisanship, the maps skewed toward Republicans in both the state legislature and in this congressional map. So in litigation, in the state courts, the state Supreme Court concluded in a divided opinion that the state constitution of North Carolina prohibits partisan gerrymanders. And it prohibits them because the North Carolina Supreme Court looked at four different provisions of the North Carolina Constitution and said when it construed those together, you couldn't unfairly advantage one party over another in drawing these maps. And Republicans in the legislature were obviously unhappy with that, and they petitioned for certiorari to the Supreme Court. You might say, well, this is a state court issue dealing with state constitutional law. What could the federal government and the United States Supreme Court have to say about this? They're appealing only the congressional maps because they're pointing out that under the United States Constitution and what's known as the Elections Clause in Article 1, Section 4, it says that the legislature thereof in each state is responsible for setting the times, places, and manner of holding elections, but Congress can make or alter those regulations. And the argument goes, we're the legislature, says the North Carolina petitioners, we are the ones who draw maps. And for the state Supreme Court to swoop in, read this provision of the Constitution, several provisions of the Constitution, none of which directly address partisan gerrymandering, for the first time in over 200 years of state history, essentially usurps this power of the legislature to draw districts. And so that's how the case sort of gets framed and set up before the Supreme Court.
So a lot of this case really comes back to the text of the Constitution and the fact that the Constitution makes these references not to states or not just to states, but specifically to state legislatures. You mentioned already that there is one such reference in the Elections Clause that kind of lays out the distribution of authority around congressional elections for Congress, of course. Another provision, similar language, appears in the Electors Clause, which relates to how we select a president through the use of the Electoral College. And it appears a few other places as well. Notably, I believe it used to appear in regards to the provision about selecting senators that was subsequently amended to allow for popular election of senators. Tell us a little bit about why the Constitution makes this use of state legislature, the different ideas about what this might mean, and the different ways that these references to the state legislature have led to these different visions about how these authorities operate.
Yeah, it's complicated in the sense that when we think about legislature, we might think instinctively, oh, it means this body that meets in each state and is responsible for the lawmaking. And in most states today, it's a bicameral legislature. That's the institution that's responsible for this. And the thought was, especially at the founding, that state legislatures were by far the closest to the people and the most responsive to public interest and public needs. And there are many places where they refer to legislature as the actor that is responsible for these things. So taking a non-controversial but interesting different example, thinking about ratifying constitutional amendments. You know, if you want to amend the Constitution, it has to get through three quarters of the legislatures in the states. And that has been understood as a pretty robust power of legislatures to act on their own. They follow their rules. They're given this constitutional mandate. They don't have to submit their votes to a gubernatorial veto if there's a veto in that state. So there's this robust authority to ratify constitutional amendments. Or there was a robust authority for them to choose senators, as you point out, prior to enactment of the 17th Amendment and the direct election of senators. So the court, however, has looked at legislature maybe a little bit differently depending on the clauses, but recognizes that legislature still means something different from state. And in fact, this clause says, you know, that the state is supposed to do this, but it's really the legislature that makes this choice. And so there's been some tension over the years to think about, well, what exactly can the legislature do uninhibited by other checks in the state, the executive, the judiciary, the state constitutions, because it's been given a function under the United States Constitution and is therefore unimpeded by other state mechanisms or apparatus. All this is to say it only applies in congressional elections and, as you put it, in presidential elections. And in congressional elections, there's an express power of Congress to step in and also make or alter those laws. So even if the state legislature in its most robust theory is uninhibited in some respects by some of these other state actors, there's also the opportunity for Congress to step in. But again, thinking about how legislature works when it's lawmaking versus ratifying, when it's lawmaking versus electing, has led to some of this tension as the courts have begun to think about this notion of how the legislature acts here.
And just to dig a little deeper on this, you know, one aspect of this that I've always found very interesting to me is the relationship between a state legislature and a state constitution. Because at least I've always thought of, and I think this is in practice how every state I'm familiar with has operated, although I wouldn't be surprised if maybe there's some quirk I'm not aware of. But, you know, state legislatures are the products of state constitutions. State constitutions define what a state legislator is and create them. Does that fit into this theory at all? Is that part of the debate? I mean, how do people push back against this idea that we are supercharging a state legislature with particular authority, given that the state legislature itself is a product of these state constitutions that now the federal constitution is, at least by one reading, seeking to limit or constrain in the authority they can exercise over their own creation?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's this great meta question, right? Like, what is the legislature? It is defined by state law. There is the guarantee clause of the Constitution that says Congress guarantees each state has a republican form of government, which we think includes some legislative power. But again, within the states, their constitutions define what is the membership, what is the composition. It often will define how many people have to be there for a quorum. It will define the sort of procedures that are in place for gathering together and voting on issues. It might say that it can't be called in a session except on certain dates or subject to the governor's call. So there are all these sorts of meta issues defining the institution of the legislature itself within state law. And to my knowledge, people haven't really challenged that, right? The Constitution of the state creates the legislature, defines its scope and authority, and that is something that's acceptable as sort of a procedural value. But then the question is, once you've created that legislature, what happens when it's given these federal functions, this federal responsibility to choose senators or to ratify constitutional amendments or to make rules pertaining to presidential or congressional elections? The question is there something sort of substantive within each of those grants of authority? And not just within the grant of authority generally, what's the manner of holding elections, what is the election of senators, things like that, but is there something within the institutional definition of legislature that therefore prevents the state constitution from adding constraints? It can maybe define the legislature, but can it otherwise provide substantive constraints? And so that's where the heart of this dispute really is. Several years ago, the Supreme Court considered a case out of Arizona where the people by referendum had created this independent redistricting commission that would essentially do the job of the legislature when it came to drawing congressional districts, precisely because we want to avoid partisanship and gerrymandering. And when the Supreme Court affirmed that in a closely divided case, the majority of the court said, well, we talk about lawmaking function, and Arizona has long defined the lawmaking function to include the people who can be a part of this. So it did look to the state constitution in terms of defining what this legislative power was. And for the dissenting justices, it was very much, well, the state constitution can't take away the institutional legislature. Nobody thinks that the people are the legislature. So again, it gets to this fight about how much work the word legislature is doing independently within the constitution, above and beyond what state constitutions define as the legislature and the scopes and bounds of its authority.
So this case relates specifically to the elections clause, to how the federal government and the states collectively manage federal elections for Congress. Tell us a little bit about what the consequences could be, the implications could be for this decision, acknowledging that there could be a range of possible outcomes. But what would a decision that supports the independent state legislature doctrine of one stripe or another, or goes as far as the challengers want to in this particular case, mean for how we approach congressional elections?
Yeah, I mean, I think people have to realize that you have to jump through a lot of hurdles before you get to a case where this theory would apply, right? It only applies in federal elections, congressional elections. Constitution is pretty much silent when it comes to state constitutions, subject to some constitutional amendments extending the right to vote. It really does not trump federal law or the federal constitution. So if you have a due process or equal protection claim, if you have a Voting Rights Act claim or a Help America Vote Act claim, right, those things are not going to trump what the states are doing. And even internal to most states, you know, state courts still have the power to review statutes, to interpret ambiguities in statutes. That's usually something that is ordinary lawmaking functions in the state. They might say, this executive decision or this election board decision is inconsistent with the state law, does that all the time. But the question arises in sort of a narrow set of cases. Now, it can be significant, but it's a narrow set of cases about those places where perhaps state courts or state or local authorities are making decisions that perhaps stray from what the legislature has enacted by statute. And that could be interpreting the Constitution. It could be interpreting an existing law that maybe strays from what the legislature thinks is a better interpretation of the law. And that could then provide less of a check from these other branches on what the state legislature does. And in its strongest form, might invite the state legislature to violate provisions of state constitutional law to the extent that they provide voting rights guarantees or other constraints on the legislature, if the legislature chooses to ignore it. So that could be the outer bounds of it. So you see it in the case here in North Carolina. One reason this comes up is because there's no direct federal law relating to partisan gerrymandering. There have been bills floating around in Congress, but they've never been enacted. There's no other, it's not a Voting Rights Act violation here. There might be other challenges to certain districts under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, but that's not what's at issue here. And the state constitution doesn't have an express partisan gerrymandering clause. And so under a stronger version of this theory, it might be that state constitutions can never constrain them. And states like Florida or Ohio that enacted constitutional provisions that constrain how legislatures do partisan gerrymandering, all those things would be unconstitutional. But in its weaker form, and that's where I think this court seems to be going, although we might see, it might be in states like North Carolina or Pennsylvania, where there's no partisan gerrymandering clause in the state constitutions, where these constitutions have been on the books for over 200 years, and the state courts show up and say one day, aha, now we find that there's a anti-gerrymandering clause in this provision or in this series of provisions of the state constitution. And for some justices on the United States Supreme Court, they've already suggested, well, maybe North Carolina just went too far in this case. It went too far in constraining its legislature through interpreting its own state constitution. And opponents would point out, this is a heavy lift for the United States Supreme Court to step in and tell state courts they're doing state law wrong. So it's trying to figure out if the Supreme Court is going to step in with a weaker version of the theory, that you've just gone too far, a stronger version of the theory to suggest that the state constitutions can never substantively constrain the decision-making of legislatures. It's going to be a question of where they're choosing to draw those lines and essentially second guess what's happening in the states.
So the congressional impact is certainly a potentially significant one, although you know there's kind of a spectrum of potential outcomes. But interestingly, even though this case, Moore v. Harper, focuses on congressional elections and the elections clause, a lot of the public commentary, and particularly some of the more urgent or alarmist public commentary we've seen on it, has actually focused on the Electors Clause and presidential elections, even though that's not directly at issue here, presumably on the assumption that the Supreme Court, how they approach the definition of legislature here, will bear on that other context as well. And this is particularly alarming for folks because of ties to the role of state legislatures in proposals put forward by supporters of President Trump in 2020, John Eastman theory that, you know, at least having state legislatures step in and provide a kind of final check or revision on which among purportedly disputed or contested slates of electors is actually the proper one after Vice President Pence purportedly under his proposal would have declined, refused to count ones where there was a dispute. This kind of fits in there. Tell us a little bit about what this decision might and might not mean for presidential elections, because there seems to be a lot of confusion as to exactly what this might mean at its most extreme outcome, and then also a little bit of confusion about what the state of the law already is around state legislature control about over electors.
Yeah. No, it's great. There's confusion is maybe a kind word here about some of the things that have been said on the presidential election front. So again, it's worth noting that there's a parallel clause for presidential electors that the state legislature gets to direct the manner of appointing presidential electors. And again, right now in all 50 states, it's by popular vote. There's all kinds of provisions about early voting, absentee voting, about times and poll places and things like that, right? So typical rules that typically run parallel between presidential elections and congressional elections. And so you're right that if this case comes out in a way saying, well, maybe the state constitution doesn't constrain the legislature in some form, then it would apply not just in congressional elections, but it would apply to presidential elections too. And then in the same way that if state courts stepped in, and one of these cases arose in 2020 out of Pennsylvania, to say, aha, you know, I know that the state legislature passed a law saying ballots have to come in by Tuesday, but we're reading this provision of the Constitution to say there's a free and fair election that should be held, and ballots can come in until Friday, because we expect the high volume of absentee voting, the mail service is unreliable, we want to make sure people are able to effectively cast their vote. So saying Friday when the statute says Tuesday is a potential significant departure from that legislative scheme. Again, state constitution might be interpreted by state courts in an ordinary way. But one of those disputes that arose in 2020, maybe the most salient one, was that the decision of the state Supreme Court to construe this in a way that directly contradicted what the legislature had previously enacted. And so what might happen, and again, the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, and consistent with Secretary of State guidelines in Pennsylvania, said, why don't you set aside any of those late arriving ballots, and we'll figure out if there's a dispute how to sort out this Tuesday versus Friday deadline. And there were about 10,000 ballots, and those weren't in dispute at the end of the day because Biden won the state by many, many more times than that. So there was this potential tension that arose about how to handle these ballots and whether or not the state legislature had gone too far. Now, that's a very different notion, though, than a lot of the things that have been floating up about what happens with presidential electors. The next link, and it's a broken link in the chain, in my view, is to say, well, aha, we have doubts as the legislature about how the election's been run. So we want to show up in December or January, well after the November election, and we're going to pick a new set of presidential electors, and we're going to send them to Congress ourselves because we're the legislature. We get to direct the manner of appointment. And we're just going to show up sometime later and say, this is our presidential elector slate. Let's send it in. And we're going to identify the winner as somebody else than the popular vote held. There are a lot of problems with this that do not relate to the issues and Moore versus Harper, except for this sliver, which is the theory of the independent state legislature, which says, you know, things like the state courts can't say Friday when the legislature has said Tuesday, for instance, it gives a little bit of an authority to the state legislature to say, aha, see, somebody wasn't following the rules. But then everything that flows from that is not an issue in Moore versus Harper and has a lot of other problems. The legislature can't show up after Election Day and pick new electors. Congress has the constitutional authority to pick the day, the time of choosing electors, which is the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. So you can't show up in December, January legislature and pick a new set of electors. There's a provision in federal law that says if there's a failed election, you can come up with a backup plan. Almost no state has a backup plan in place. You can't just show up and create your own backup plan. You can't just say an election is failed because you don't like the outcome or that the state courts or the state executive has done something wrong. States have enacted recount and audit and contest procedures to resolve that. You can't show up after an election and vote for somebody else inconsistent with the popular will because you've set the rules before the election and there are significant due process and equal protection problems under federal law, regardless of what the state legislature does. So these theories that later arose in sort of the run-up to January 6, 2021, about legislatures convening in December or January, picking their own slates and sending them along to Congress, none of that is permitted or would be permitted, whatever the outcome of this North Carolina case is.
And just to drill down a little piece of this into part of the discussion here that I don't think people are necessarily fully aware of, is that kind of under existing law and historical practice, state legislatures actually can and have directly appointed electors early in the Republic. The question is whether they can do it before an election or after an election, as defined by the date by Congress. Is that basically getting it right here? Is that this case, I mean, that ability isn't really brought into question by this case or addressed by it, but is something that people seem a little unaware of and be blending in here, at least by my reading.
Yeah, this is a great irony, right? All states except, as far as I'm pretty sure it's all states except Colorado. Colorado is the only state that has a provision of its state constitution that says we're holding a popular election for presidential electors. In all the other states, I don't think there's any such constraint. And as understood at the founding into the middle of the 19th century, and in fact, as sort of ratified by the Supreme Court as recently by Justice Kagan in her opinion in Chiafalo versus Washington involving faithless presidential electors back in 2019, the thought is that when the state legislature may direct the manner of appointing electors, it can hold a popular election like all 50 states do today. But the state legislature can also say, we're just going to pick electors. Many states did that up until about 1824. By 1824, most states had moved away from that system. In 1860, South Carolina was the last legislature to do it, with a little exception of Florida in 1868 and Colorado in 1876, where the legislature just picked the electors on behalf of the members of the state. And if a legislature tomorrow wanted to pass a statute saying in 2024, we're just canceling the presidential election, we're just going to meet on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, we're going to meet as a legislature, we're going to pick a bunch of electors, and then our election will be over. That's almost not a problem anywhere in the country. So the question then is like, well, why aren't states doing this? It seems like a very complicated and convoluted solution to say, well, after the election, we're going to have our doubts and second guess what happened. And then, but I think people realize, like, one, taking the popular election away from the people for president is a really significant political act. And I think would not be well regarded even by members of your own party if you were saying, oh, well, we're just going to do it this time. I think there's huge political opposition to it, even if it's technically legally feasible. And another is the legislature knows the shoe can be on the other foot sometime. And if the legislative control flips to somebody else, you feel like maybe you've got more of a shot with the people and campaigning there as opposed to the fixed body of the legislature, which you can pretty much count votes very quickly and know how the outcome of the presidential election is going to be determined. So it's interesting to me to think that there is this mechanism that's existing, largely non-controversial, and yet no legislature is exercising right now. And it, I think, highlights we can have concerns about the United States Supreme Court stepping in and saying, states, you're getting state law wrong. I think that that's a really legitimate concern. I think there are potential major fallout about how states administer elections if that is carried through to maybe its more extreme or strongest forms later on after Moore versus Harper. But it's very different from suggesting that the legislature could just somehow show up and choose its own electors after Election Day, or that somehow that authority that it concurrently exercised before the election is perhaps the forgotten thing that is perhaps even more remarkable and yet not being exercised by the states right now. So I appreciate the opportunity to sort of separate that pre-election choice and decision about how the rules are going to be run with some sort of showing up after the election and trying to undo the results, which run into all kinds of federal statutory and constitutional problems.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
You should celebrate yourself every day. But some days, you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
So just to bring this back to the context that I think most people are thinking about this case, and perhaps wrongly, which is the 2020 election dispute and the shenanigans around leading up to January 6th, 2021. The proposal we have from, you know, John Eastman, Ken Cheesebro, and other folks that essentially boils down to, okay, Mike Pence, what you should do is, you know, refuse to count these state electoral slates where there's some pretext for a debate as to whether they're legitimate because of false claims of electoral fraud or whatever else to have you, and then say we have to kick this back to the states for them to vote on. And Eastman seemed to be reading into this idea that the state legislature, their imprimatur, will make that ballot and give them the authority to choose, at least once Pence does that, if perhaps even Pence doesn't have to do that, in his view. That argument, even if there's a decision in this case, in Harper v. Moore, that strongly supports what we are calling the independent state legislature doctrine, which is this idea about, you know, the stronger role of the state legislatures versus other state institutions, does that even necessarily support or tie in or provide any added support to an Eastman-type theory? Or is it really unrelated? Are people getting these two things too confused?
It has this marginal relationship of, if the courts buy into this theory, it strengthens arguments that people like John Eastman might make to legislatures to say, aha, see, something was fishy, let's show up later and vote for a different slate of electors. So it gives you a little bit of that air of legal defensibility to say, this theory is out there and it's up to you to sort of recognize it. But to the actual functionality of everything else, it doesn't really play a role. If, Eastman's theory really turned, and it's consistent with the existing Electoral Count Act, which is one reason I think some reform efforts are trying to clean it up, was that it really needed some statement from an authority of the state indicating this is the proper slate of electoral votes. No state legislature did that. No state legislature came close to it. There was no even single chamber that did so. But if it had done that, it would have put in front of Congress potentially multiple slates of electors that had some imprimatur of authority from the state and would have forced the state decision to be made inside of Congress. But again, that has nothing really to do with whether or not the state legislature has this choice ahead of election day to sort of define the laws as it sees fit. It's really a different theory about legislative power designed to act as a wedge in the existing Electoral Count Act to try to get something in front of Congress that has some aura of state legal authority so that the Congress can count one thing over another, have some choice to count one thing over another. So it really is more focused on thinking about the clarity of the Electoral Count Act, along with, you know, some of the more remote things, thinking about the vice president's unilateral authority to make these decisions, and much less about the legislature's ability to define the rules ahead of an election about how to count absentee ballots, or what kinds of signature matching requirements have to be in place, or the deadline on which ballots have to be in place. Those are the issues that will sort of form the bulk of disputes if Moore versus Harper comes out in favor of the petitioners in the North Carolina legislature. It's really going to turn much more on those nuts and bolts of election administration and the rules that are set in place ahead of election day, not sort of the Electoral Count Act related stuff.
Now, one sort of provision that does exist in some states, and actually in North Carolina, if I recall, I don't know if it's the only one, I know it's one of relatively few, is a provision that actually does kind of build into the rules for how the state handles presidential elections, at least. I don't know what it does for congressional elections, but builds in a clause that's been in state law for a while now in North Carolina, and was there in 2020, that says under certain circumstances, I think in that case, it's if they dispute over election or the electors haven't been selected or resolved within 6 days of kind of the cutoff of the actual Electoral College voting date in North Carolina, then the governor can come in or the state legislature can come in and appoint somebody, establish a procedure that departs from the popular election results. Could we see provisions like that? Is that what would be necessary for a state legislature that wanted to assert this authority after the election to do so? And are there still issues with their ability to kind of ex ante build those rules into the system? And I suppose would a potential ruling here impact how those provisions are interpreted and the extent of authority they could give state legislatures after the fact? Is there a little bit of a risk there that if states were to take that step, this may actually strengthen their hand a little bit more than it might be otherwise?
I think the answer begins with saying Moore versus Harper doesn't have a whole lot to say about this. It's because it really relates to a different provision about the timing of choosing presidential electors. Congress has that power to pick the time for when electors can be chosen. And right now, again, first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. And then it's also picked a second time. If states have failed to make a choice on the day prescribed by law, they can later on show up and choose electors. Now, at the founding, there was actually a long period for states to hold their presidential election over a period of weeks. In 1845, Congress says, we're just going to pick one day now. But some states had majority requirements, and so they needed to have a second day where they could show up because they failed to make a choice if a candidate only received a plurality of the vote. So they needed to have a backup for a second day to show up. States don't do that anymore. So the question is, what's this failed to make a choice provision doing? And Congress can pull that away tomorrow. And I think Electoral Count Act reform might choose to either pull it away or significantly constrain what it means. And so North Carolina, as far as I know, there have been some constructions about what happens in Michigan, but really North Carolina is the only state that has an express provision. It was enacted in 2001, right after Bush versus Gore, and right after Bush versus Gore, where Florida was running up against this deadline under the Electoral Count Act, 6 days ahead of when the electors meet, to try to resolve all of its disputes and controversies. And the Supreme Court took that date as very significant. So the North Carolina legislature in 2001 said, well, you know what? If we don't get our act together and solve our disputes over presidential elections by 6 days before the election, we're going to deem the election failed, and the legislature shows up and it gets to cast votes in the best interests of the people of the state of North Carolina. So that's the only statute that expressly provides that. And it might be that other states could come up with similar statutes, but they haven't right now. They could right now, actually, well before the election, pass statutes saying we are the canvassing board, or we count votes, or we're going to make a determination. We're going to be the court of contest if you have a challenge, and come to us and resolve these disputes. So state legislatures haven't been moving in that direction in the last couple of years. Again, setting aside what Moore versus Harper might require, you know, they would be empowered to make some of these things and decisions, perhaps or perhaps not, subject to state constitutional constraints. But in terms of the after the election, states haven't been moving in that direction for some reason, and maybe because they realize it's complicated, messy, and problematic. Only North Carolina has this statute on the books. And it might very well be that Congress chooses to pull that away or limit it at some point in the near future if it reforms the Electoral Count Act. And again, the state legislature can't just show up in mid-December and say, we've had a failed election. There are significant due process and equal protection concerns, which have a pretty long pedigree now in the federal courts, to say, you know, changing these rules well after the fact that affect fundamental rights, treating voters quite differently based on this fundamental right to vote. There's great skepticism, I think, in legislatures just showing up and saying we have a failure, as opposed to North Carolina, that defined, you know, if we haven't resolved all the controversies that have been channeling out there, we've been unable to certify the results, the election has failed. But in all 50 states this election, in 2020, we didn't have a failed election. Every election was successful. There was certification by the executives. Every judicial decision was resolved, right? So I think trying to figure out that hook of what is or isn't failed, something Congress can figure out, and something that state legislatures, regardless of the outcome of this North Carolina case, have the authority to fix right now ahead of the 2024 election.
All right. Well, now we've taken care of this little bit of a divergence into the Electors Clause and these other issues that are so tied in here in the public commentary. Let's zoom back to Moore v. Harper itself and talk a little about where this case may be headed. Because it's kind of a interesting, not unique case, but a little bit exceptional case in that we have a little bit of a window into how this court's addressing this already, because they briefly considered whether to grant a kind of consider on emergency basis earlier this year, declined to do so. But we had a few justices write opinions that hinted at how they think about this issue. The biggest contingent of them was Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas, all of whom wrote a kind of three-page, four-page opinion that when the court declined to take up the case earlier, said essentially, well, look, we would support taking up this case. In part, that's because we believe the challengers in this case have made the better case, that in fact, the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, has gone too far in this particular case in pushing back against the actions of the state legislature, precisely because of this legislature language in the elections clause. We also, of course, Justice Thomas joined Chief Justice Rehnquist's concurrence in Bush v. Gore. So we have a little bit of a window into how he thinks about this as well. What is your sense about where these justices fall on the spectrum you've already carved out for us about the more limited versus the broadest vision of this doctrine? Or do we not have a sense of that from what they've already given us, the hint they've already given us about how they're thinking about this issue?
Yeah, it's very hard because it's a lot of glimmers and hints. It's a lot of things that happened on an emergency basis during the 2020 election to say, well, let's put this on hold, or we think the state court has gone too far right now. Let's set aside this batch of ballots in Pennsylvania and we can resolve the disputes later, right? And so that's not really addressing the merits. It's just sort of setting things up for future inquiry. Now, in this case, though, when it did come up on an emergency basis before the Supreme Court, and three justices, led an opinion by Justice Alito, would have granted the stay, but a majority denied the stay, to say, well, Justice Alito says, this is an emergency case right now, but I think right now, it seems like, based on the briefing I have, that the legislature's gone too, or that the state courts have gone too far. There has to be some limit on state judicial authority, and the state Supreme Court showing up and reading four separate provisions of the state constitution to provide this sort of penumbral right to anti-gerrymandering provisions, it just goes too far, at least based on the record he had before him. And Justice Kavanaugh wrote separately indicating that he wasn't going to grant the stay, he was going to deny the stay, and that the lower court ruling would remain in effect. But Kavanaugh said, you know, we got to resolve this. These cases have been churning around for a while, and like it would be nice for us to provide some clarity. It's very unclear to me whether that's saying I would love clarity because I think the doctrine is correct. In fact, he was involved in Bush versus Gore back in the day, which included that Rehnquist opinion in Bush versus Gore, thinking about legislature means legislature and you can't go too far. But he's been, you know, it perhaps interested also in reaching this same outcome that Justices Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch suggested in their dissenting opinion. And these cases stretch back for many years about separate opinions and sort of hints of the doctrine. Again, a number of these emergency cases in 2020, but even back in shortly after Bush versus Gore, there was a case out of Colorado involving redistricting, where the legislature tried to redistrict, couldn't, the court entered a map, and then the legislature showed up to try to redistrict again in 2003, and the state Supreme Court said, no, you only get one shot, you can't draw the districts again. And the Supreme Court didn't take the case, but three dissenting justices, Rehnquist, Thomas, and Scalia, said, well, you know, I mean, you kind of took away the power of the legislature here. We would love to hear this case. There must be some limit on what the power of the state courts is when it comes to restricting or restraining the power of a legislature. So you've had a number of different hints over the years of different justices suggesting there's some merits to this. But then, you know, sort of get to your question about where might they go with it. You know, at least Justice Alito's opinion, you know, suggests that he's looking at some kind of outer bound theory, that there's just some times where the state legislature or state Supreme Court goes too far in cabining the state legislature by departing from 200 years of state constitutional law jurisprudence, let's say, when it comes to partisan gerrymandering. But, you know, that's a pretty generic standard and a hard thing for the federal courts to patrol. And a stronger version of the theory that says, well, the state constitution can't substantively constrain the judgments of the state legislature, you know, again, subject to federal oversight and all those kinds of checks, would be much more significant, right? It would disable a number of provisions in state constitutions around the country dealing with rules and regulations pertaining to federal elections and how they're administered. But that theory to me seems less likely to garner some support. As the Supreme Court's decision in Rucho versus Common Cause a couple of years ago suggested, where they said the federal courts are not open for business for partisan gerrymandering claims, they're non-justiciable. The majority went out of its way, an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, but joined by others who did not write separately, who said, you know, while the federal courts are not open for business, the states might be. And in fact, Florida has passed an anti-gerrymandering provision to its state constitution that very explicitly gives state courts guidance for how it's supposed to go about patrolling partisan gerrymanders. So I think it'd be very hard to get a majority of the court interested in throwing out those kinds of provisions too, at least the more explicit anti-gerrymandering or other provisions of state constitutional law. But certainly, and I think it's gotten a lot of the attention, it's certainly theoretically possible that if the court in Moore versus Harper says, aha, well, this is too far, that it opens the door for further challenges to other more explicit constraints on state legislatures as they're found in state constitutions. My guess is the Supreme Court doesn't have the appetite for that, but that's only a guess, and time will tell.
That kind of brings us back to, you know, the other branch that still has some input in this, and that is Congress. At least, well, certainly in the Elections Clause context, Congress is explicitly given a fair amount of authority that can even supersede state authority. And it still has a role in the Electors Clause context, if maybe not quite as expressly and broadly construed. What could, if we are to assume that there might be a very broad ruling in support of independent state legislature doctrine or something on that spectrum, people are alarmed by that. What might Congress be able to do about it in terms of writing out rules, whether as part of Electoral Count Act reform that you've already mentioned or as other legislation that might be able to cabin that authority or at least some of the more problematic uses of that authority that people seem worried about? Or is it really a case where Congress's role is pretty constrained?
No, I mean, Congress has plenary authority here. Congress can pass whatever it wants. And I want to set aside, and it's a super complicated topic that might come up in a case in Arizona in the very near future about the distinguishing Congress's power over presidential and congressional elections. Let's set that aside for the moment. Just focus on the congressional elections piece, where Congress has plenary authority. It can do as much as the state legislatures do. It can do whatever it wants. So it requires single-member districts, for instance, right now, and it requires compliance with the Voting Rights Act, and it requires a whole host of other things, from, you know, militaries and overseas voters being mailed their ballots 45 days before the election, to limiting or permitting how states go about list maintenance or voter purges to clean up their voter registration forms. It's authorized motor voter. It's there are a variety of provisions throughout, especially the last 60 or 70 years, thinking about affecting congressional elections in particular, and at times, especially with the Voting Rights Act, state elections. So if Congress wanted to tomorrow, I mean, could pass a statute that says, here's how you draw districts and you can't gerrymander and here are the standards for gerrymandering. Or maybe a little more controversially, if we think about delegation, saying your decisions have to be approved or have to go through an independent redistricting commission or some bipartisan commission before they can be approved by the state legislature. So those have both been proposals in Congress in recent years. They haven't gotten out of the Senate because of the filibuster, but you know, there are also 6 or 7 pages of 900 page election omnibus bills, which have proved more controversial. So it's also thinking about some of the political judgments of Congress to say, if we're really concerned about partisan gerrymandering, should we pass a partisan gerrymandering statute? Or we're really concerned about states restricting absentee voting, should we expand absentee voting as we did in the Uniformed Overseas Citizen Absentee Voting Act and the MOVE Act and other bills that Congress has enacted to think about enabling voting access in federal elections? So it's always in, you know, within the authority of Congress to make these decisions. And there are many who are cynical, especially today, to say, well, Congress can't, you know, can't get together, can't resolve these things. These are hotly contested, contentious issues. And so that's true. And so it's, what are you going to do? And we're waiting to see if there's bipartisan support for Electoral Count Act reform, which addresses some of those issues, not directly at issue here. But if Moore versus Harper does come out in a way that puts some constraints on how state courts are checking state legislatures, I think it does put all the more pressure on Congress to make decisions that it thinks are in the best interests of administering federal elections, if it feels like state legislatures are going to be less constrained or misbehave at a higher degree than they were in recent years.
We're almost out of time, but one last question for you just to dig a little deeper on this. Are there specific, you know, narrow legislative reforms that seem to make more sense to you if Congress or whoever group of whatever part of Congress is working on Electoral Count Act reform, or the January 6th committee for that matter, may also roll out its own proposal of reforms in the next couple of weeks, that they should be focused on if they're actually worried about the state legislatures attempting to exercise more control over presidential selection? You already mentioned, I think it's 3 U.S. Code 2, if I recall correctly, which is the kind of backup provision. Are there like specific parts of existing Electoral Count Act, existing law that warrant perhaps more focus for those who are most concerned about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, we haven't seen legislatures really try to directly defy state constitutional law. Right? They haven't really tried to show up and say in Florida, this anti-gerrymandering provision is just something we're going to ignore and run roughshod over. We haven't seen that a lot. And maybe it's we haven't seen a lot yet, or maybe we haven't seen a lot because the legislatures are pretty deferential to when the state constitution is explicit. North Carolina, not very explicit. The other place where these controversies arose has been less legislatures passing statutes that just conflict with the state constitution and more state executives construing statutes in ways that might stretch the bounds of state law. And like we saw sometimes this happen both in North Carolina and Minnesota in 2020 with some consent decrees entered into by executive branch members and attempts by the legislature to have judicial review by saying, aha, the executive has done something here that we can't do, or that we can't get our hands around because the executive has defied what the legislature has done. And courts have been mixed in how far the legislature can defend a statute in these cases. But again, another case where the executive might go too far. So we haven't seen many places where the legislature just sort of up and directly enacts a statute that violates the state constitution. And in part because many of the challenges to existing statutes in Georgia and Texas, recently enacted bills, are happening in the federal courts. They're challenging under federal constitutional guidelines, National Voter Registration Act, the Voter Rights Act, whatever it might be. So again, it's trying to figure out what are these narrow classes of rules that the legislature could pass that evade all of the federal checks and yet might run afoul of some state constitutional provisions that maybe we want more federal oversight on. And it might be, I think, that the pandemic really highlighted sometimes the inflexibility of statutes when it comes to emergency provisions about how to do things on a one-off basis for absentee voting when we're trying to do less physical in-person opportunities. So it's hard to nail down what exactly are the kinds of things Congress could do that aren't being done by the existing federal statutes. Now, I do think as Congress looks at things like the Freedom to Vote Act or the Voting Rights Amendment Act or things like that, they've identified a wide variety of things that states are doing that they just think are on the merits, things they shouldn't do and should be subject to review. So changes to, you know, election procedures should be publicly disclosed, or we need to have more robust opportunities for mail-in ballots and that absentee voting should be on a no excuse basis, as opposed to on the basis of some excuse before you can vote by mail. Or we need to have much longer early in person voting opportunities, or we need to allow ballots to come in after Election Day, which some states permit and some states don't permit. So again, these are all rules that I think there's been robust debate about what the best rules are, what the ideal ones are going forward. But again, we think about Moore versus Harper. It would only be if those rules all passed existing federal muster and a state court tried to say, aha, you can't do this, legislature. It runs afoul of the state constitution under a generic clause like the Free and Fair Elections Clause. So if legislatures started trying to do things that ran up against what state courts have said, those would be the pressure points, I think, that Congress would be looking at. But again, so much of the existing litigation is happening in federal court over new voting laws that states are enacting. Let's try to figure out where would be those more narrow sorts of areas that all survive federal scrutiny and that simply are subject to some state constraints. And so I understand the concerns for many thinking about, well, Moore versus Harper can really usher in this opportunity for legislatures to do whatever they want. But given how existing federal regulations have cabined and constrained how states have been moving forward, I think it's sort of an open question to me about what legislatures might try to do in the future for Congress to really focus on.
Well, we will have to leave the conversation there for now. Derek Miller, thank you for joining us here today on the Lawfare Podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please be sure to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And look out for Lawfare's other podcasts, including Rational Security, a weekly conversation about national security that I co-host with my colleagues Quinta Jurecic and Alan Rosenstein. Be sure to visit lawfareblog.com for extensive written coverage of national security law and policy issues, and consider becoming a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare to gain access to an ad-free version of this and other Lawfare podcasts, among other perks. This podcast was edited by Jen Patcha Howell, and our audio engineer was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.